Author John Meacham reflects on divisiveness and the politics of fear throughout American history. John Meacham is a close watcher of the American presidency. He has penned award-winning biographies of presidents including Andrew Jackson, Thomas Jefferson, and George H.W. Bush. So his instinctive reaction to the current political times and our president's words and actions was to summon up his knowledge of history to try and put the hate speech, rancor, and divisiveness into perspective. The result? Meacham's newest book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we'll talk with Meacham about the parallels he finds in U.S. history and the lessons for all of us. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Tune into the news these days, and it's clear that our times are marked by conflict and division. But things may not be so bleak, according to John Meacham. In his new book, he looks at examples from history when hope overcame fear. We'll learn about what he believes the past tells us about our present and future on today's program. Joining me from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., John Meacham, a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer and best-selling author. He has written about Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, Franklin Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, and George H.W. Bush. He's also a contributing writer for the New York Times Book Review and a fellow of the Society of American Historians. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you been thinking about what's happening in our world today from an historical perspective? Do you have questions for John Meacham? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. John Meacham, why did you write this book? Was it personal? Was it your own sort of reckoning with the times we're living through?
Reckoning's a big word, but yes, it was. I started it after the events in Charlottesville in August of last year, when the president of the United States had a hard time deciding whether he was on the side of the counter-protesters or on the side of neo-Nazis and Klansmen. And I thought that that was a remarkable failure of moral leadership. And one of the questions I get, I'm sure you get it all the time, is, has it ever been like this? Have we ever seen anything like it? We're getting to the point where the answer is no most of the time. But there have been eras in our past that have been marked by contention and division and a sense of gloom, not unlike the sense that we confront today. And so my attempt here was to try to not tell everybody to relax. My message is not, we've been here before, so relax. It's that we've been here before, we've come through it, so let's learn from how we overcame these seemingly insuperable moments in our history and try to apply those lessons.
Sure, you hear that all the time. You hear people saying, these are the worst times in American history, or this is the worst since the Civil War. And your book sure lays out an argument for, well, not so fast.
Yeah, exactly. It's from Appomattox. I'm a Southerner. The war, Civil War, in some ways never really ended. White Southerners attempted in many ways to carry on the struggle by other means. It led to a century of Jim Crow. Only 55 years ago did functional apartheid end in my native region. Women have not yet voted for 100 years in this country. That'll be next in 20. It'll be a century. 3 years ago, gay Americans couldn't marry. And so my hope here is not to provide a kind of cultural Zoloft, but to argue that there is proportion and perspective are essential. And without understanding that the incumbent president represents a vivid manifestation of many latent and perennial themes in the American character, I don't think we can wrestle effectively with suppressing those characteristics and trying to heed what Lincoln called our better angels.
Your book highlights stories and people in American history we don't talk much about anymore. We don't know much about. It was one of the most interesting things to me about your book. And I'd like to start by having you talk about the roles of Presidents Grant and then President Hayes in the late 1800s. Yeah. I confess, I really didn't know much about them and did not know that Grant had taken such political risk why don't you take the story from there and what he did?
Well, he did. Andrew Johnson had been a debacle as a president. He was a Democrat who'd been put on the Republican ticket in 1864 as Lincoln faced a wartime election. By the way, when you're about to set your hair on fire today, remember this. Where else in the world but in America would a wartime president convulsed by civil strife hold a free, fair, and open presidential election and be fully willing to accept the results? Abraham Lincoln held an election in 1864. It's one of the great achievements that we don't talk about in terms of Lincoln's legacy. Johnson was a white supremacist. He opposed the 14th and 15th Amendments. He opposed the attempt to actually make the verdict of the Civil War a full reality for African Americans. The impeachment almost worked against him in 1867-68. And in these years, starting in late 1866, the Ku Klux Klan was founded in Giles County, Tennessee, and quickly became an effective and important terroristic organization. U.S. Grant, General of the Army, comes in as president and takes an extraordinary level of political risk, as you say, crack down on the Klan, and he basically did away with the Klan. The origin of the modern Justice Department actually is the battle against the Klan in the South. But is the great phrase of American history, right? We all, you know, we said we were all created equal, but we didn't mean it. You know, there's always FDR was a great man, but he interred the Japanese. You know, there's always that's the nature of history. That's the nature of our reality. In 1876, Rutherford B. Hayes, who's running for president as he's the Republican, Samuel Tilden's the Democrat, and Hayes agrees in a very close election, always in Florida, of course, it's always Florida, to withdraw the federal troops from the last remaining states in the South, thereby ending the Reconstruction Project and enabling virtually all white governments in the South to impose the regime of Jim Crow that shaped American life until 1965, when Lyndon Johnson managed to marshal the great heroic work of Rosa Parks and John Lewis and Diane Nash and Martin Luther King and so many others and end that apartheid. But it's from 1877 until 1965, you did not have, there's some exceptions, Harry Truman started to do the right thing. Basically, you had an acceptance of an order that is now so reprehensible to us that we can't even, it takes an extraordinary amount of imaginative work to put ourselves back there.
Another moment in history I didn't know about till I read your book was about Teddy Roosevelt inviting Booker T. Washington to dine at the White House.
The first year he was president, Washington was a great educator, a great leading intellectual, and T.R. was interested in the work he was doing, invites him to dinner at the White House. The press goes crazy, just saying that, saying things that I can't repeat about how could you let this thing in the White House? It was subhuman language. It was eviscerating language. And T.R., to his credit, said in a private letter to a friend, "I realize now from the reaction how important it was to do this." And in 2008, when John McCain conceded the presidency to Barack Obama, he mentioned that moment. He said, we've gone from an era in which in basically a century from a man coming to dinner at the White House was the cause of great controversy to electing an African-American president of the United States. And that is evidence of the essential not always guaranteed, obviously, but the basic impulse toward progress that is part of the American story.
Another thing that really struck me, and again, all these echoes between past times and today, you're talking about when the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan in your book, it reemerges in around 1920, and something that struck me is you write, in a dynamic that's familiar in our own time, hostility from the journalists of the East convinced a number of middle of Americans that a cause under such assault must have something to recommend it. So this is another one of those themes throughout history, isn't it? That certain factions use paint journalists as the enemy and are able to whip up a support using that.
The Klan, which was refounded in 1915 at a time of immense transition pressure from an agrarian to an industrial society, a time of great immigration, a time of great anxiety on the part of the white working class that immigrants were going to come in, work harder for less money. That was an explicit concern. Led to this new movement, taking the trappings of the old Klan. It was enormously important in American life for about 10 or 11, 12 years. There were 3 to 5 million Americans who claimed to be members of the Klan. 50,000 Klansmen marched down Pennsylvania Avenue without their masks on. At the 1924 Democratic National Convention, there were 347 Klan delegates that forced the convention to 103 ballots before they finally defeated Al Smith, the governor of New York, who was an Irish Catholic. It was a very fraught moment and fell apart partly because Harding and Coolidge did the right thing. Two Supreme Court decisions that really undercut the power of the Klan. And thank God it did for all sorts of reasons, not least that had the cataclysm of the Great Depression come with 3 to 5 million, an infrastructure of that many shock troops, it's harder to see how Franklin Roosevelt might have been able to preserve democratic capitalism in the way he did. But two things that helped the recruitment for the Klan in its heyday, in its second heyday. One was, as you say, the press. When the press spoke out against it, there were a number of people who thought this is the best thing going because anything that the press hates must be good. As Mark Twain once said, history may not repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And so here we are. And the other was congressional investigations. 1921, there was a very important series of hearings. And the guy who was running the Klan, who was basically a PR guy, said, we got more new applications. We won more new members when Congress took out after us than we had beforehand.
It was so interesting to me what happened with Calvin Coolidge. And to paraphrase what I learned from you, John Meacham, is that Coolidge was encouraged to speak out, to make a lot of noise about the Klan, and he decided to really kind of be quiet, knowing that if he made a lot of noise, more people would join and that it would burn itself out. And I'm wondering, that's so fascinating to me, and I wonder if there's a lesson for today's times from that.
Well, I know there are a lot of Republican senators who hope so, because that's the bet that a lot of lawmakers are making. To say that Coolidge kept his mouth shut, of course, is redundant. The great story about him is a woman walked up to him at a White House dinner and said, I have a bet with my husband that I can make you say three words. And he said, you lose. So Coolidge is an interesting figure. But he did, he wrote letters about it. He attacked organizations. He didn't use the name. And really did lay out a moral case. It wasn't a moral case that we would all swoon over today, but this was 1920. And so you have to, one of the things you have to do when you think historically, obviously, is you can't automatically apply all of the customs and points of view of our time back on them. You have to take them for what they were and in the context of their time. And both Harding and Coolidge were not unimpressive on this. I think of all the periods that we can look back on, I do think that the 1920s and the 1950s, the early 1950s with Joe McCarthy,
are the
two most analogous. And they're not perfect analogies, but there are these recurrent themes of populist leaders who understand fear, who play to those fears, often exacerbate them. The great public leader, the great populist leaders, almost always understand the media of the age in an interesting and important way. Huey Long understood the radio. Charles Coughlin understood the radio. Joe McCarthy understood exactly when the newspaper deadlines were, so he could make outlandish charges before the reporters had any time to check them, but then had to file their stories. That tactile sense of where a significant amount of the public is in their cultural habits is something that drove the rise of the 45th president, not just the social media, though that's important, but also the vernacular of reality television. The incumbent understands how to produce these shows, these episodes. He's told, the New York Times reported, he told his White House staff during the transition that he wanted them to think of every day in the White House as an episode in a TV series where he vanquished his rivals. So we don't have to stretch too far here to understand that what we're dealing with is a figure who understands the media, understands fear, and who has made a decision, I think one that will cost him historically, has made a decision not to reach beyond that base, but to continue to stoke the fear as opposed to appealing to a sense of hope.
Sure. So many analogies, especially with Joe McCarthy in your book. I want to ask you, John Meacham, about your reaction to yesterday's news conference in Helsinki and President Trump's words yesterday.
Well, I was sort of, I don't want to say thunderstruck, that's probably the wrong word, but as I was watching it, I was thinking, how on earth could this go any worse? If you had in fact scripted something, you know, if some deeply left-wing group had said, this is what's going to happen, you would have thought, well, I think they're going too far. Basically, the president did everything except speak Russian. And I think that the nearly universal reaction is heartening in many ways. I don't know enough. None of us know enough, it seems to me, except for Director Mueller and his team, to know whether there is something behind this. My own gut is that at a certain point, if it quacks like a duck and walks like a duck, then it's a duck. And it seems to me that we have a president of the United States who is not putting the interests of our nation first in a way that totally confounds the last 75, almost 100 years now of American foreign policy and national interest, which has been an opposition to tyranny. We fought a Cold War in order to preserve Western institutions, the rule of law, fair play. And we now have a president who seems much more interested in appeasing a neo-czarist, neo-Soviet dictator who has extraordinarily grand designs on expanding his influence in the rest of the world.
We do have to take a break. John Meacham, I want to come back after the break and ask you what you've learned means for all of us and what our marching orders are, if you will. But we
sure
do have to take a break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Email us at talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Taggart Construction in Freeport, working to create healthy homes that respect the environment since 1994. TagCon.com. And Lamy Wellahan Shoes, committed to reducing greenhouse gases at all their locations throughout Maine, because what's good for the environment is also good for business.
When President Trump spoke alongside President Putin in Helsinki, he undercut the work of his own Justice Department.
The probe is a disaster for our country. I think it's kept us apart. It's kept us separated. There was no collusion at all.
Trump's embrace of Russia and its implications this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how Wisconsin went from blue to red. We talk with Dan Kaufman, author of The Fall of Wisconsin, about how a state long known for progressive politics came to embrace a governor who attacked public employee unions and helped send Donald Trump to the White House. It's a story of dark money, gerrymandering, and Democratic complacency. Join us.
Tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, The Soul of America: Can Hope Overcome Fear? Joining me from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., John Meacham, who's a best-selling and Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian who has written a new book called The Soul of America: The Battle for Our Better Angels. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. But before we go to those calls, John, I want to ask you about that subtitle, The Battle for Our Better Angels, and what conclusions you have drawn from looking again at history through this lens.
I think we have about five institutions in the basic Republican, lowercase r, context that as long as two or three are rowing in the right direction, we can endure a great deal. There's the presidency, the Congress, the courts, the press, and the people themselves. And it is a fact of American history. This is not an ideological point, but it is a fact that the great advances in American life, the movement toward a more perfect union, have come from the populace itself. It's come from us, and politicians are far more often mirrors of who we are than they are molders. I think that's an important point, and I think it's an encouraging point as people go through this incredibly difficult time. My basis, I think that, you know, this is not a prayer, it's a plan. We have to resist tribalism. You have to be able to say something bad about the good guys and good about the bad guys if there's an intellectual reason to do it, if there's a data-based reason to do it. Reason is absolutely essential, and we have to respect facts. In my argument about this, and I've tried to widen the aperture as much as possible in order to bring in both conservatives and liberals on this point, is that the American experiment in many ways can best be understood as the largest undertaking in Western history in which reason was given a chance to stand against passion in the arena. That is, the life of the mind, the ability to reach conclusions, the entire Enlightenment, scientific revolution tradition would be a player in our political life, not maybe the dominant, perhaps not the dominant one, because passion is always there. But that's what the framers understood. They understood that we were driven by appetite and ambition. They understood that our gut was going to win out over our heart and our brain more often than not. So the Constitution, in many ways, was really the product of this sense that the divine right of kings, the divine right of popes and prelates to tell us what to think, had to give way to an individual sense of sovereignty. And so what came out of the American Revolution was this belief in individualism and this belief in reason. The Constitution codified that. And the Constitution, and I hope this is somewhat reassuring to folks, the Constitution was written for moments like this. It was drafted for this. It would have stunned the framers, actually, that it took until 2016, 17, 18 for there to be a demagogue at the head of our affairs. They were ready for it at any moment. They were thinking about Aaron Burr, maybe Patrick Henry, someone like that. But they clearly, the Federalist Papers are all about this. They worried, that's why we have the Electoral College, ironically. It's why we have the checks and balances. The Constitution takes into account that we're going to do the wrong thing most of the time. And so I know that's frustrating hour to hour. I know it's, and I know people are thinking, well, we've never had a president who's an agent of a foreign power. I understand all of that. But in the main, the institutions we have should be commensurate with this moment. What it requires, and you have certainly senators there who are vital to this, it requires all of us to make ourselves very clear to the people who have the legislative authority. And without that conversation, without our activism, without our bearing witness, things might not change. Things might not get better. But if we, the people, are in the arena, I think reason has a pretty good chance of winning the day.
We'll go to Mike, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah, pardon me while I douse my hair here, and it's still smoldering. But look, I start to draw analogies to some kind of a civil or uncivil war. One scenario would be that the people actually do have a sort of an epiphany here as to what kind of government has been elected, and in my mind, the treason that's going on now, and actually do something about it. Because in that case, I got a feeling that a whole lot of folks that love Donald Trump, they own most of the guns, and they are motivated. And, you know, I don't see why we believe this can't happen here. It happens everywhere in extreme circumstances. They tend to be, you know, to draw a broad brush, the alt-right tends to be more motivated. They tend to be more violent. They definitely have the guns, and they're well represented within the military.
Yeah, Mike, I'm sure.
Stay on fire.
Yeah, and John, you talked about the events in Charlottesville as being one of the catalysts for you to write this book.
Mm-hmm. You know, nothing is impossible, obviously. History is, it would be foolhardy to say that. My own view is that the system is stronger than that. But the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. And the concerns, the cares and concerns that lead to that scenario have to be taken incredibly seriously.
Mike, thanks for your call. I'm going to go to Greg on Facebook. He writes, I've lived in Maine's second congressional district since 1990. I see the big divides between the billionaires who repair their yachts in Belfast and Mainers in the interior who suffer the century-long decline of the farming and paper industry. It's no surprise that the district voted for change in 2008 with Obama, and we voted for change again in 2016 backing Trump. We need the second congressional district to be rebuilt with great jobs. If manufacturing can't come back, as Trump promised, we need free tuition and great schools to attract young families and single-payer health club and clinics everywhere. Among other things, to heal the divide, we need investment in rural America, and we need it now.
Well, that's a fascinating statement because it suggests my conviction anyway, that we're living to some extent in the political equivalent of climate change. There's extreme weather, right? It's hot one day, it's freezing the next. They're spring and fall are gone. It's either summer or winter. It is not at all impossible, it seems to me, that people who voted for President Obama, who voted for Donald Trump, might not, as your messenger writes quite specifically, might not end up with Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or someone on that part of the spectrum the next time. Because if you voted for Trump, if you wanted these jobs back, if the jobs aren't coming back, where does that lead you? It leads you to the tuition. It leads you to single payer. It leads you to a progressive agenda. And so we have this remarkable moment where we tend to be bouncing from guardrail to guardrail. We've always done that in terms of the temperament and character of the leaders of a given era. Hard to imagine more different men than George H.W. Bush to Bill Clinton, Bill Clinton to George W. Bush, George W. Bush to Barack Obama, Barack Obama to Donald Trump, right? That's like the C-SPAN Star Wars bar scene. They're just very different people. But now that's taken on a more of an ideological component, more of a philosophical component. And so I would not be in any way surprised to see that we might, as soon as 2020, veer from a nationalist, isolationist, populist man running on the Republican ticket to an extraordinarily progressive Democrat taking over the presidency. It wouldn't surprise me at all.
David on Twitter asks, how does history suggest Trump will fall from favor with his current supporters?
Well, yesterday helped, I got to tell you. People, the way these fevers break, so let's just argue from analogy. Joe McCarthy broke because people realized the emperor had no clothes, or at least he had no communists. They watched him on television. They saw him sweating. They saw him being a bully. They didn't like it. And McCarthy began his rise in 1950 with in a world of radio and newspapers, and it ended in an era of television. Mm. So that's an interesting point. President Nixon, interestingly, Nixon fell largely because he actually obeyed the rule of law. Now, before people start screaming, you know, he didn't burn the tapes. He turned them over. He followed the Supreme Court ruling. Nixon fell really beginning the 24th, I think, of July, which was the Supreme Court ruling, and then was gone by August 8th. There is this legend out there about how, oh, if only we had Barry Goldwater again. I love that liberals now think that Barry Goldwater should be resurrected. Goldwater and Hugh Scott and John Rhodes did go to see Nixon to tell him he didn't have enough support in the Senate to sustain a trial on impeachment charges. But that was August 7th of 1974. Nixon announced he was leaving on the 8th and was gone on the 9th. So the idea this was somehow an extraordinary profile in courage, it was more of a incremental conversation. But history tells us that the bright lights of exposure, which certainly Trump has, matter. It shows that people do tend to get tired of the show. Franklin Roosevelt said that there's something in the human psychology that cannot stand to hear the highest note in the scale repeated again and again. And I do think it not impossible that Trump wears out his welcome here. Specifically on the base, if it comes out, if Director Mueller comes back and there is proof that, in fact, he has been unduly influenced by Russia, I still think there's enough of the old Reagan base out there to say, you know what, that's a bridge too far.
We'll go to Chris calling from Lewiston. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. So I'm one of the hair on fire kind of folks who also recognizes that there's been times in American history that it's obviously been infinitely worse than what we've got. Civil War, you know, Jefferson and John Adams writing their truly inflammatory stuff when they were in power. But the difference today, I think, is that the media is so severely divided that even the most basic facts that, you know, 20 years ago, the press across the board would have probably accepted as true is now no longer the case. And so you say that you take solace in the idea that there's kind of universal, almost universal opinion about how bad things went with Trump yesterday. But if you go to the Washington Times, you know, the headline is basically liberals attacking our great president again. And then all the comments about what Trump said are all stuff that's just wildly and insanely not true. I mean, things that are just instantly verifiable as false. So in the current media situation where like a very good friend of mine, a very rich millionaire guy, truly believes stuff that is completely false because the only media he goes to is, for instance, the Washington Times and Fox. Hmm. How do we turn direction? How does the battleship change course if so much of the population believes stuff that is false and they can win without winning a majority of the vote?
All right, John?
It's a great question. Two things. One is, even if they put Trump in an orange jumpsuit and render him back to Moscow, 35% of the country is going to be with him. So you just have to accept that. McCarthy's approval rating after the Army-McCarthy hearings was 34%. Nixon was at 25%. So there's a significant chunk of the country, and they're loud, and they're the people who, you know, not only watch Fox News, but tend to produce it, apparently, who are simply tribally committed to this man, to this moment. And then they'll be tribally committed to something else down the road. So what you're really focusing on, what one should focus on, it seems to me, my opinion, is the middle 20% of kind of persuadable people who are open to reason and argument. The thing about the media is, in point of fact, the 20th century that we think of as a common era media of fact, and we all had one conversation, and Walter Cronkite, et cetera, was the exception, not the rule. You mentioned Jefferson and Adams. Jefferson funded the first opposition newspaper to the Washington administration. All newspapers were partisan until really the early 20th century. The reason the New York Times became a more or less neutral umpire was as a market proposition, because there were 39 other papers in New York in 1896 when Adolph Ox bought the paper. So I'm not saying this is a good thing, because if you look at the 1850s, you know, how many do you think that Southern planters were encountering a lot of different views as they went about their lives? You know, they were in a bubble. They received newspapers that affirmed their views. I think it's a serious, serious cultural and political question that we do not have a common set of facts. But the only thing I would offer is we've had more years in this country without that than we have with.
We do have to take another quick break. We're speaking with author John Meacham. His most current book is The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Two Fat Cats, scratch baking with an emphasis on Maine desserts and pies, in Portland and South Portland, and at twofatcatsbakery.com. And The Cedars, a nonprofit senior living community in Portland since 1929, offering independent living at the atrium, thecedarsportland.org.
Safe spaces, trigger warnings, campus speech codes.
Are we coddling students?
Focusing on enforcing safe spaces is a dangerous distraction from the university's core role.
From Intelligence Squared US, where the world's leading thinkers debate today's most critical issues, the next debate, trigger warning. Are safe spaces dangerous?
We need a safe space so students can learn, so they can tolerate disagreement.
Coming up shortly at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
A big conflict between Russia and the West is in eastern Ukraine. Next time on The World, a family that flees the area when their apartment is struck by a mortar.
There we have chickens.
They resettle in the countryside. There's nature all around. Neighbors are glad they came, because few people are willing to live so close to the site of a nuclear meltdown. War refugees settle near Chernobyl on The World.
That's at 3 o'clock this afternoon here on Maine Public Radio. Tonight at 10 on Maine Public Television, Frontline, Blackout in Puerto Rico. Frontline investigates the humanitarian economic crisis in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. With NPR, the film examines how the federal response, Wall Street, and years of neglect have left the island struggling to survive.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, John Meacham and what history teaches us about divisive times. John Meacham is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and biographer. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Before we go back to the calls, I want to ask you, though, one of your biographies was about Andrew Jackson, and President Trump is such an admirer of Andrew Jackson. What do you make of that?
Well, presidents see as they wish to be seen, and so whenever presidents talk about predecessors, it's always very revealing. In honor of one of your summer residents, let me tell you a quick story about George H.W. Bush, Andrew Jackson, and Donald Trump. I know it sounds like a joke, right? And there's one parachute. But Trump was coming down to Nashville, where I live, to lay a wreath at the Hermitage in March of 2017. It was Jackson's 250th birthday. And I was sitting at home and I was thinking I should do something. So I decided to write an open letter to the president saying that if you're going to embrace Jackson, don't just embrace the crazy parts, which is easy to do, right? Jackson once said there's only two regrets in public life, or that he had not hung Henry Clay and shot John C. Calhoun, who was his own vice president. We now know that no one felt that way about their running mate until John McCain, actually. But anyway, I wrote this saying, you know, Jackson was actually a more subtle operator for all of his problems, all of his complicity in the tragedies of American life. He kept the Union together. And so this is the Jackson you should embrace, sir. So I wrote it as an open letter. It ran the local newspaper. It had no effect whatever, of course. But the next day, I'm walking into lunch, and my phone rings, and it's George H.W. Bush. And his staff had given him this piece to read. And so he said, "How you doing?" I said, "I'm fine, Mr. President. How are you?" He said, "I'm fine. I read your letter to Jackson." I thought, ooh, you know, the old boy's losing it, right? He thinks I'm writing letters to dead people. And I said, "Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. You know, actually, it was a letter to Trump about Jackson." And without missing a beat, Bush said, "Yeah, but Jackson will pay more attention." So he's fine.
We'll go to Ann Lynn, who's calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Ann Lynn. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. So right after the Civil War, Henry James visited Richmond, and he noted the Southern genius for creating an alternate reality through active and ardent propaganda, reorganization of the schools and such. And then he goes on to say how the tone of the press at the time strikes us as queer and quaint and benighted and looks to us as artlessly perverse. So I'm interested in that 35%. I'm interested in the people who are listening to InfoWars. And, you know, I see it going back to this Southern education in alternative reality.
Well, it is fascinating. I will say this. I don't think it's regionally based. But there is a tribal impulse. It's an ancient impulse when you think about it. Actually, the American experiment in many ways, the experiment in the West, is fascinating, not least because, in a way, it's anti-evolutionary in the sense that there is a tribal impulse. Because if you are around a campfire with people who think like you and look like you, you're safer than if you're alone on the plane and someone comes and gets you. You don't want to be prey. You want to be the predator. And so the impulse, the social impulse, what Aristotle would think of as our being social animals, is a fundamental human tendency. The great achievement of literacy, the great achievement of enlightenment, the great achievement of the millennia is that we can actually think as well as act, and think before we act. And I think that in many ways, a reflexively tribal, a reflexively partisan, as opposed to reflectively, it's okay to be partisan, just you have to at least think about what the other people say before you disagree. That tribal tendency to always say that whatever someone on the other side wants to do is wrong is in many ways almost pre-literate. It's instinctive. And what we have to do, and what I'm trying to do with this historically based argument, is to say we have achieved greatness in this country. We have achieved, though we have far more to do, we have in fact expanded the definition of what it means when we talk about human equality. We have done so by listening to the other side and by reaching a kind of Madisonian compromise, and that's not a partisan point, it's a historical point. We are a stronger country the more widely we open our arms. That is not a partisan point, it's not an ideological point, it's a historical one. We are the most diverse democracy, the most complicated enterprise in this form of government, and we are always better off, all of us together, the more generously we interpret the definition, the founding premise of the country that we're all created equal.
And Lynn, thank you for your call. We'll move to Buxton and Peter. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon. It's a great honor, John Meacham, to have a conversation and be in contact. Yes, a phrase for my take on this culture is epistemic crisis. And one of the favorite phrases from the Vietnam War era is, we don't know what we don't know. One of the things that I'm aware of is that we have sort of a diminishing ability to inform ourselves wisely. I took a class when I was in college, theory of knowledge and various, graduate level philosophic stuff that I actually failed to grasp, but I did understand a fair amount of it. And it seems to me that it used to be, you know, if we wanted to know something, if we wanted to look something up, if we wanted to get reassurance on the truth, we would reach for the Bible, and that's all there was to read. So now we've got all these various forms of information showering down upon us, and we have to make choices, and we don't know how to come up with something we can say we know because of so many choices and so many perspectives. And the result is we get confused, we get fearful, and resort to a lower level on Maslow's hierarchy of human needs. We get primal. We get into the feel protective position and try to make the best of our lives as we can with a fear base and a lot of ignorance. And so the 35% are simply relying on what they know from that fetal position of fear and insecurity.
Thank you, Peter. John?
Yes, I think that there's a lot to that. I think that there is a that there is something elemental in this, which is not to say that if you think about things, therefore you're going to be a liberal Democrat. That's not the point here by any means. The point is that we, for 75 years in this country, just to take the last 75, we had an ongoing political conversation, figuratively, between Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan, right? So from 1932 to 2016, every president, every Congress basically acted along a certain spectrum. Even President Obama was really dealing with a world where it was a question of the relative role of the state versus the market. And that conversation came to a halt on election night 2016 because this era doesn't fit into that conversation. This is a complicated miasma, really, of nationalism, populism, xenophobia, pro-Russia. It's just a weird combination. It's a weird part of the dialogue. And my belief is that, historically speaking, this will end up being a chapter, not the whole book.
Thanks for your call, Peter. Love some of the quotes you've chosen in the book, John Meacham, of course, and especially Lyndon Johnson and Harry Truman. And I'm going to sort of read the last quote from Truman is my last question to you, where you write, "The country has to awaken every now and then to the fact that the people are responsible for the government they get. And when they elect a man to the presidency who doesn't take care of the job, they've got nobody to blame but themselves."
Truman spent a lot of time in Independence. He lived for about 20 years after he was president and left this remarkable canon of those kinds of insights. And we do. We get the government we deserve. I understand all the forces that people, you know, it's a minority government. He didn't win the popular vote. And by the way, I would have a very different tone if he had won the popular vote. I think that that's one of the things that reassures me moving forward into this remarkably perilous time. And it is perilous. But as Truman said, ultimately, we are responsible for what happens, and it requires exhausting and exhaustive citizenship. But this is a stress test for who we are.
What's next for you?
I'm doing James and Dolly Madison. I think really created both the Constitution and then the beginnings of a political culture that did in fact give reason a chance against passion. I've been thinking a lot about this because so much of the incumbent president's métier is simply stoking passion and hoping people don't deploy reason. And what I would say going forward here is I would hope that everybody would resist the tribalism, would try to find some critical balance, would respect facts, deploy reason, listen to the other guy at least for a minute before you disagree, because that's how we've gotten through this before. Is it guaranteed? Absolutely not. But if you look back at how the fights we fought in the past, the battles we've won, the wars that we've come out of, we are still at a place, remarkably, where our immigration issue in this country is that people want to come here. And so what is it about the country that makes people want to come here? Let's preserve that, nurture that, and I think we'll be okay.
They're such eloquent words. I'm wondering, though, do you worry that you are a member of that much maligned elite, that you are about as firmly implanted as others, and that others will say, well, if John Meacham says that, it must be wrong?
They can say that even without my being an elite. say it. Fight with it. Argue with it. But the reason I did this was I believe everything I've said. I believe every word I wrote. I believe that this country was founded on an idea. The idea has been tested and battered all the way through. We have been led by wildly imperfect people because we are a wildly imperfect country. But by and large, people want to come here. They don't want to leave. And I think that it's worth the struggle. It's worth the fight. People want to dismiss what I say because of how I make my living. That's actually proof that I just need to keep making the argument more.
Well, thank you so much for being on the program. That was John Meacham. He's a best-selling author and Pulitzer Prize-winning biography. His new book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, news and advice from our technology experts. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.